Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the Woodward Centre. Welcome to the Melbourne Knowledge Week and welcome to what I think will be a fascinating discussion. My name is Glenn Davis, the Vice-Chancellor of the University, and it's a real delight to be your host tonight. I begin, of course, by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, and acknowledge elders past and present. We have a very distinguished audience, and I don't want to go through a long list, but I do want to acknowledge that it's a significant week in the life of Peter Harris, who's just been announced as the new chair of the Productivity Commission. So, Peter, welcome. We're delighted that you're joining us tonight. You have a formidable job ahead of you, but you will do it brilliantly. And welcome to the inaugural DICE lecture. And DICE, as you just saw on the screen, is a dubious analogue for Dialogues on Innovation, Creativity and Entrepreneurship. It works. It's got a nice sense of risk about it. It's a risky title, and it captures the idea that innovation itself is usually about risk. Now, when we think of innovation, we typically think of business. We think about IBM or Apple. We think about Microsoft. We think about many corporations. But tonight, I guess, we're making a claim that universities are an important part of the innovation cycle. Not the innovation cycle, but they matter as research, as teaching centres, as places where knowledge is developed. And every university in the country can tell a story about a particularly exciting piece of innovation that arises from that institution. Here we often tell the story of Professor Graeme Clark, who developed the cochlear ear and brought, therefore, hearing to the profoundly deaf, and whose company, or whose research led to the cochlear company, which has been a great Australian company with global reach. We're trying to do it again. In fact, we just announced an appeal this morning to replicate for the blind what has been achieved for the deaf through the Bionic Eye Project, which is a grand coalition of institutions around the country. The first clinical trials only a few months ago. We are on our way, I think, to produce it, to making it possible for the blind to regain some sense, some sight. Never perfect, but anything that's an improvement is a great contribution to quality of life. And it's one of those innovations that, if it works as we hope, will lead on to lots and lots of commercial applications. So we hope tonight to pick on some of the ideas that are around innovation, to think about the innovation cycle, to encourage the conversation about what we are doing, what we're not doing, what we know from elsewhere, and what works and doesn't work. And many people in the room have a lot to contribute to that discussion. And what we hope to do tonight is to hear from two really distinguished people who've thought a lot about this question, and then to go to a conversation, which is what we very much look forward to do. So Jim Minifrey and Jeff Mulgan will be our speakers, and the conversation will be very ably facilitated by Charlie Day, Dr. Charlie Day. We're going to hear first from Dr. Jim Minifrey. He's going to set the scene. He's from the Grattan Institute's Productivity Growth Program, and he's going to talk about Australia's performance on innovation, our strengths, our weaknesses, and current policy frameworks. And after Jim, we're very fortunate to hear from Dr. Jeff Mulgan. Jeff joins us from the UK, where he's the CEO of the National Endowment for Science, Technology and Arts, or NESTA. He has had some fascinating roles over many years. He was Director of Policy at 10 Downing Street under Prime Minister Tony Blair, Director of the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit. During the 90s, he also co-founded and directed the think tank Demos, which was described by The Economist as the UK's most influential think tank. He's also served as Chief Advisor to Gordon Brown, MP, but I think his most important role is one that's been sadly underplayed in his CV, because it's not well known that he went on the road with a group of musicians known as Red Wedge in the 1980s. According to Billy Bragg, the young Jeff Mulgan drove their van. True, well, Jeff, according to this interview, laughs nervously. "I did drive that van," he said. "Not very well, sadly. It wasn't one of my more heroic moments. I'd forgotten all about that. I wasn't in charge. I was only the driver." That's the last time Jeff Mulgan can say that, because he's been ever since an extraordinarily influential person in policy. We hope the dialogue that starts tonight will continue through this series and will help encourage all of us to think about innovation and the role it plays. So to start us, can I invite with great pleasure Dr. Jim Minifee.
Thank you so much, Glenn, and it's a real privilege to be here tonight. What I wanted to cover was really four topics at a high level. The incredibly important role that innovation has played for Australia, plays as a driver of well-being across the world, and will need to play if we're to confront the challenges that Australia and the world face going forward. The second one, just a very brief snapshot on some of the important angles of how Australia does innovation and how we are generating outcomes through the way that we approach the innovation challenge. I've got, a relatively brief observation about changes in the landscape of innovation that I know, Jeff, you're going to touch on in much more detail, but there are quite material changes in the way that collaboration, knowledge search, and problem solving can be undertaken that mean that the central role of universities, the central role of knowledge management, and the central role of collaboration between researchers and industry will be adjusting to those changes in technology. And then I'm going to finish with a set of open questions, which I know there are members in the audience who've got strong points of view and expertise on, and I'd love to hear during the discussion. So let me just start. Why innovate? So the first is, if you're a very narrowly focused economist, you'd say, ultimately, the only way to drive income over the longer run is to innovate. Productivity is the main driver of incomes because you can't change participation forever. You can't change the capital stock forever. And so innovation, including what's embodied in services and products, has to be the main driver of your increases in income. There's an enormously broad front of current innovation to be drawn on globally. 98% of it is, quote unquote, not invented here. And a huge part of the challenge for Australia is interacting with and accessing that huge pool of radical changes in technology and business practice, organisational practices. But it's not just about that narrow income or GDP focus. Innovation is necessary to advance a whole range of other things that we care about and need as a society. Health doesn't show up anywhere in GDP, certainly longevity doesn't, some of the other dimensions do. Managing our environment and getting the most out of our natural resources for non-GDP purposes is a huge, huge challenge. And then finally, we've got to play our role in delivering global public goods, playing our part as a member of the global community. And I think just the note of caution would have to be that Australia has had a phenomenal run of GDP growth. We've had an even better run of national income growth on account of the terms of trade. It's very unlikely that we are going to get that sort of tailwind going forward. And I've just noted four reasons why I think there's ample basis to be looking much, much harder at productivity growth and therefore much, much harder at innovation going forward. So first, those one-offs from the terms of trade that gave us probably 15% increase in income through the 2000s are very unlikely to repeat. But unless they reverse, the pressure on the tradable part of the economy, that is not resources, will continue. So the terms of trade may come off. Volumes, however, are going to grow of resource exports. And as a result, the real exchange rate may not drop back that much. And so what you're seeing in terms of pressure on, well, let's take education, right? We've become a higher cost provider than we were 10 years ago. Manufacturing, that's certainly true. And so the need to think really hard about how to drive value for our global customers when our cost base has changed puts innovation front and centre. The third point, demographic headwinds. This is the year that the first of the baby boomers, born 65 years ago, are now in the retirement window. What we're expecting to see is a headwind of about 0.3% of GDP as the labour force to population ratio declines over this decade. So that starts to hurt. And then finally, we know that there are inevitably going to be, or very likely going to be, significant cost associated with climate change adaptation
and mitigation going forward. And so for all of those reasons, and I'm sure there are people in the audience who could identify more, innovation has never been more important. Let me just share a couple of charts with you. Labour productivity as a percentage of the US level peaked after a phenomenally strong productivity growth cycle around the late 1990s and has fallen significantly since. You can do the same exercise on multi-factor productivity growth, where the light coloured bars are the growth rate up until 2000 from 1985, and then the dark ones are the 2000s. And you can see Australia there in the middle with a significant drop-off in our multi-factor productivity growth rate. And so while I think productivity specialists in the room would appreciate that we would naturally expect something of a return to productivity growth, and indeed our last year's figures have been quite strong, as the very large investments in the mining sector in particular begin to pay off in the form of bigger outputs. Nevertheless, you don't want to have another decade like the one we've just had in productivity terms if you don't have resource prices holding up your real income. And so for the community, driving productivity potentially is going to be the one thing that will drive income growth this decade. Now, I just wanted to share my take on some of the very, very broad, very deep, radical, continuous, progressive, and in any given year, kind of negligible in most industries, set of innovations that over time are going to transform our economy. You know, again, there'll be people in the room who come up with a bigger list or a longer list, but let me go through. Construction, you're moving from a CAD world to a building information management world, where instead of just generating architectural drawings, you're moving to a world where buildings are designed, tested, engineering properties are handled, and then the management systems of the building are generated in a computer environment. That's combined with changes to construction technology, really reshaping the construction industry. Second, one word for education, everybody's thinking about what online means. Energy, low emissions generation, and smart grids, transforming that sector over the next couple of decades. Entertainment and media, the four words that I've picked, mobile, streaming, user generated, and social, transforming that sector. Finance, there'd be others, but let's look at high-speed trading and dark pools, where essentially the traditional model of stockbrokers and exchanges is being transformed and overturned predominantly by increasing capability of computer systems. Government, you've got challenges around open data, the challenges around privacy of matched databases between income tax and other financial databases. Procurement models are also being overturned. Healthcare, personalisation of healthcare responses, new diagnostics and therapies, electronic records. And you can read the rest on the slide, but there really is quite a profound transformation going on. Now, I'm not asserting that the rate of transformation is higher now than it was in the past. I think there's been an ongoing transformation driven predominantly by technology over time, but there are some special features about what we're experiencing at the moment. First, it's very IT-based for the most part, and it's very networked. And I think those two drivers are really common across sectors. And so thinking hard about what does that kind of new networked economy mean for a knowledge centre, for a university, and for industries in terms of learning about the frontier of knowledge and understanding how to interact it and profit from the changes in sectors is, in my view, a profound question for the university. Now, Australia looks pretty much like the OECD average, both in terms of R&D expenditure at a government level and at a private level. But you can see that we are significantly below the leaders, the heavy investors, in private sector research and development, which is an important, not the only, but a very important part of innovation. Now, it's possible to make the case that, well, our industry structure is different. You wouldn't expect us to have quite such a high level. But nevertheless, that industry structure is a reflection of some of our underlying capabilities. And so it's just worth pondering what the role of R&D needs to be going forward as the leading countries continue to build their expertise and build their depth across the industries that they are leading. I wanted to dive a little bit into the role of government and private. So I've got two slides on the role of government and private sector innovation. And to my mind, there are two main takeaways here. The first is, and you can see on this slide, I've got really two rows: business model innovation, commercialization and adoption, which is the sort of more applied end of the spectrum. And then I've grouped together directed, strategic and basic research. You can see in the first column that public expenditure is predominantly in that directed, strategic and basic research area. But there's even more of that kind of activity being done by the private sector. The second observation I would make is, you can see I've written a plus on private expenditure on business model innovation, commercialisation and adoption. It's very difficult in this country to get a number on how much private sector investment is being undertaken on innovating business models and on transforming businesses in response to these new opportunities. I suspect that number's really on the order of one or maybe two orders of magnitude out. I mean, if you ask a typical CEO of a business, how much of your investment is related to exploiting changes in technology, how much of it is related to changing your business model, you get a much bigger answer than $2 billion. But nevertheless, that $29 billion adds up to about the 2% of GDP we saw on the previous page. There's another way to cut the different focus of the government and the private sector, and that is that private sector R&D is predominantly in those three or four big industries you see on the right: manufacturing, mining, finance and insurance, professional services. There's a lot of industrial production R&D in the public sector as well. But beyond that, you've got a very, very different pattern. You've got two chunks of knowledge-based R&D where the output is not new marketable services and products, it's knowledge. The whole model for that part of innovation is based around peer review. It's the AIRC and the NHMRC. Totally different model. And then the final one around health also, and in fact that's where the bulk of the NHMRC are, of course, is health investment, where again, along with agriculture, you can make the case that there's a very, very strong public good. It's going to be underprovided unless you've got central provision. And so I think stepping back, you'd say a really interesting debate that always kind of bubbles along in the innovation world is, are those roles right? Have we got the right degree of complementarity? And I just wanted to put together my observation before that the bulk of these industry transforming changes are IT based, with the fact that relatively little public sector innovation is in that IT area. Now that doesn't mean it's wrong, but it's an important differential to bear in mind and to consider as you're thinking through how do we best complement the public and the private to get a good outcome. And on that topic, you would also have to ask, have we got the collaboration model right? If you ask innovative businesses, as the ABS does, are you really getting a lot from engagement with universities, from engagement with the CSIRO, from engagement indeed with other sort of research providers? Their answer is, look, I'm innovating my business model. I'm not talking to those entities. And again, maybe that's right because they can buy the technologies off the shelf. But those are the discussions that need to be had. In terms of outcomes, now this is not the output of a drunk spider, although it does look like it. The blue line essentially shows Australia's position versus OECD best practice around the edge, and you can see that there's a kind of spiral that takes you in towards the middle. So the top left is where Australia is really strong. And then going around to the sort of 1 o'clock position, so to speak, you can see Australia is relatively weak. Some observations pop out, which is, if I were to summarise, we're pretty good at adopting what's been invented elsewhere. We've got good entrepreneurship. Our early stage entrepreneurship is actually relatively strong. Government is sophisticated and knows how to buy complex products. But if you turn around to the generation of patentable innovations, and if you look at the proportion of firms that are bringing new to market innovations, whether it's services, products, whether it's big or small firms, we don't do as well as elsewhere. And again, you could argue, well, that's because the sectors that we're in, we're not in the business of, you know, making planes or what have you. But nevertheless, that's a fact about where we're up to, and there's, again, an active debate about whether that's right. Now, Jeff, I know you're going to touch more deeply on this, but I just wanted to flag, to my mind, one of the really critical questions now for innovation is, can we accelerate and can we do better by using new tools that will help us to learn about the state of the art and help an innovator to solve their technical problems, to find expertise, to finance, to partner, and to handle their commercialization process? There's a range of new tools, online databases, crowdsourcing, online collaboration, crowdfunding, and so forth. But I know there's going to be more discussion about those. And finally, questions that I suppose we ask ourselves at Grattan around innovation would be, Terry, I think this is your line, the first one. Where are the failure points in our innovation system? Where are we breaking down? Now, if there's anybody here from the venture capital sector, I think what they would say is, we are struggling to bridge the gap between really good ideas that have been generated, to get them through the testing process and get them out to market. A lot of that's driven by global financial phenomena that are totally outside what Australia can control. You know, there was a financial cycle, the biggest in 70 years. We're on still in the ditch at the other side of that. But there's a whole set of questions about other types of failure points that I think need to be discussed. Second, the complementarities between local R&D and broader innovation. How good do we have to be at the sort of basic end of the spectrum to be able to get the most out of things further up? Specifically around IT, what kind of public sector action is required? Can you say, well, look, hey, we do the health stuff, we leave it to the private sector to do IT? More generally, what steps would improve collaboration between industry and government? We know a lot of innovation occurs in so-called clusters where there's expertise of different kinds, complementary services, deep markets of skill and so forth. Australia has them. There's nothing the size of Silicon Valley, obviously. So what is feasible and what ought to be done? And then finally, how can we take advantage of the new tools for innovation that you're seeing on a rather spectacular level, scattered around, you know, the Kickstarters and so forth, but are these just interesting wrinkles or are they serious tools for the main game? So I hope those are some conversation starters and look forward to hearing your thoughts.
Right, well, I will hopefully pick up very much where you have started and just give a few sort of thoughts on what some of those new tools might be and where they head. First of all, just 30 seconds on sort of where I come from. A slightly oddly named organisation, NESTA, National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts. In practice, what we do is a mixture of early stage investment, usually in technology companies, up to a sort of trade sale. A lot of funding of innovation programmes in the arts, but also fields like local government, healthcare, and some research capacity on innovation policy around the world. And increasingly, this last bit actually is supporting skills development in innovation, mainly outside the UK, in fact, but trying to demystify what actually is useful in fields like design, finance, etc. I thought I'd start by showing two little diagrams. So this is these are job adverts. This is, in some ways, a very probably recognisable advertisement for someone in the innovation industry, a pretty highly specialised set of skills in a field where there will be a flow out from very specialised research labs into industry, into the market, and so on. And here is another one which probably you wouldn't recognise in Melbourne University, which is an advert for a job at Innocent Smoothies, which asks, how's your colouring in? And this is one of the most successful companies in the last few years in the UK, which has a creative team at Fruit Towers coming up with new ways of selling drinks. Now, these are almost sort of two opposite poles of what we mean by innovation. And what I'm going to try and dig into is the relationship between these and what their different position is, perhaps, in economic policy from here on in. And I'm sure you all have very good colouring in skills. Where I think we are, and this is, I'm going to sort of try and do a sort of 1 minute summary of 100 years of history. All of us, in a way, were brought up with a model of how innovation happens, which probably the Germans really invented in places like Bayer. And Bell Labs probably took to an extreme in their heyday, inventing the transistor and so on. And that's a model of innovation where there are in-house specialist centres, often employing thousands of people, a deep expertise, a deep craft and science in fields like pharma and computing, sometimes using formal methods like RCTs, very good at taking innovation rapidly to scale through industrial structures. And public funding, very important in parts of that, particularly military and pharma. And indeed, in the US and UK, it's still the case, half of public funding for innovation goes to the military. India, I think the figure is 60%. And China, nobody quite knows, but it's not far off that. And that's a model which then led to all sorts of different ways of organizing innovation within large firms, within networks, in academic structures, research technology organizations, and so on, funds, and bridges. And I put that at the bottom, the Fraunhofer Institutes in Germany being an outstanding example, which the UK is now copying with a network of what are not very imaginatively called catapult centers, but which will be taking a lot of the public funding for innovation in the UK. All of that is important and set to grow in importance. So that is a current spending pattern of different countries on classic R&D, and this is our estimates at Nesta of what that might look like in 20 years' time or so. And indeed, by 2050, we estimate as fairly good grounds for thinking classic R&D spend will be 4 to 5 times what it is today, largely, almost entirely, because of the growth of spending in China, India, Brazil, and some other countries. So a massive expansion, obviously, with a classic model of specialized, big science, tech transfer, science parks, all over the sense, the paraphernalia of innovation policy of the last quarter of the last century set to expand greatly. And any country needs to be part of that game if it wants to prosper. But what's also happening is the spread of very different kinds of innovation. And in terms of economic importance, user-based innovation, innovation in services, open innovation models, all very different approaches are arguably as important in their economic impact as that more classic model. And certainly the case for the economic impact of the military spending on innovation in countries like the US is very doubtful now. And the pharma industry is, as many of you will know, I mean, really in a position where its R&D model is widely seen to be broken and unsustainable. Now, like others, we've tried to analyze the relationship between innovation and productivity growth. And like most other estimates, we show that a high proportion of productivity growth does come from new ideas, their adoption, their use, and probably it is 100% in the long term comes from that. I think less obviously, though, we've tried to make sense in statistical analysis of what really is happening to innovation investment in the economy. And here the problem is that the measures which we have, which are really about sort of classic R&D, are quite useful for a sector like pharmaceuticals, but almost meaningless in large swathes of a modern economy. Almost meaningless in services, not very meaningful in fields like agriculture, and in fields like finance and so on, not very meaningful. So we've been developing over the last few years, particularly with the OECD, an alternative way of measuring economy-wide investment in innovation. And this is just a summary of the UK versions of this, which try to add in investment in things like design, organizational innovation, innovation-related training, software, and so on. And what that shows is a pretty large figure. So 14% or so of private sector output in the UK. Finland is the highest in Europe, more like 15 or 16 percent. And these numbers dwarf the public R&D budgets. And indeed, they are arguably more important to your overall innovation story than, in our case, figures of perhaps 7 or 8 billion, which is going into the pure public R&D. And in a way, that's just trying to confirm the point that we're not just talking about iPhones, but also things like social innovations like the Harlem Children's Zone, or frugal innovation models, that's the Akash computer in India, now on sale for $30, or tufted carpets. Very important innovation, but in a very unfashionable sector, but arguably generated as much value as many much more sort of, I guess, high-profile things. And innovations like First Direct. Paul Volcker used to say that he couldn't think of any innovation in finance which had created value rather than destroying it, apart from the ATM. But actually this bank, which is my bank in England, I would say was a genuine innovation in phone-based banking, which did create value. But again, wouldn't have been captured by any classic R&D or patent measurement tool. Now, one of the worrying things for us is that that measure of business investment in innovation doesn't look very strong in some economies at the moment. These are recent data for the UK. We are the blue line, I'm afraid, showing a stagnant position on business investment in innovation. But in many other countries too, there has been a marked stagnation. In the US, perhaps, some sort of striking patterns of behaviour with many large technology companies hoarding cash, buying back their own shares, and really retreating from investment in new products and services. And in the UK, we've shown that, in fact, that the area of biggest growth of investment in the last 10 years was buildings and concrete, not actually innovation and technology. Whereas in other countries like Korea, you've got a very, very different picture. We've tried to bring some of these things together in what we call Plan I, as an alternative to the main economic argument in Europe and the US, which is between sort of a Plan A, which is very tough doses of austerity, and Plan B, Keynesian stimulus, and have argued that regardless of the rights and wrongs of the macro policies there, there's a more fundamental question for any economic policy is how much are you investing in long-term productive capacity, which means innovation. And we've, particularly in the last couple of weeks, been trying to mobilise a coalition around using new funding sources like 4G spectrum auction to be invested directly in, say, future science and technology and growth. What I want to do a couple of minutes each on is some of the less traditional parts of that picture. So some of that strategy, which we're advocating, is fairly familiar territory, perhaps, about mission-directed programs, tech transfer, and things like tax credits. I won't say more about those now, though maybe we can come back to it in the discussion. We funded last year a very big sort of multi-university review of the evidence base on innovation policy globally, whose most striking finding is how weak the evidence base is and how incredibly rare it has been in almost any country to do proper tests of innovation policy or indeed business support. We've run a handful of RCTs on business support for innovation, but they are almost unique globally. And so surprisingly little really is known in the way that in other policy areas there is, as it were, a reasonably robust knowledge base and hypotheses have been tested and so on. And even an example like tax credits, which have been very widely researched, some of the best researchers around the world on R&D tax credits now think that almost all of that research may be rather misleading because they're being used on a vast scale, essentially for tax dodging by multinationals. And one thing to watch out for the next 2 years, I think, is some fascinating large-scale scandals around R&D tax credits. But that's you heard it here first. So what I was going to do a minute or so each on four or five of the new tools of innovation policy. The first is one which Jim mentioned, which is the use of inducement prizes to tap creativity wherever it may be. In the UK, the old example of that was the Longitude Prize in the 18th century, whose 300th anniversary comes up in 2014. Around the world, the X Prize Foundation is well known for the prizes it's done on things like space travel. SBIR are used in prize-like forms to generate new ideas from small businesses. And at Nesta, we've created a Centre for Challenge Prizes, which is running these kind of challenge prizes, not just in technologies, And on economic innovations, but also on social innovations as well, like innovations which can reduce isolation amongst the elderly, or reduce bicycle thefts and things of this kind. I would predict that these will spread substantially. They're relatively cheap, and often they generate ideas not from the normal, as it were, elite establishment institutions, but from the margins. And as a brilliant example of this, you may have seen this year the Intel Science Prize, which I think is a truly inspiring example, won this year by a 15-year-old who appears to have found a dramatically more efficient test for pancreatic cancer solely using the internet. And then a university which gave him a little bit of access to a lab. Now, that may be an extreme example, but to have cut the cost of pancreatic cancer tests by a factor of 1,000 and their efficacy by 100-fold at the age of 15 is at least interesting, if nothing else, for a different way of doing innovation. Second space, again, as Jim mentioned, lots of things happening around crowdsourcing and sites like Innocentive or challenge.gov trying to tap into, again, a wider set of ideas. And I think beginnings, too, of crowdfunding for innovation. This has happened to some extent around very specialist medical conditions where people with that condition come together to fund research. There is discussion in some countries about also having parts of national research budgets allocated as match funding for crowdfunding programs. So you actually involve the public in the things they really care about, putting some of their money into funding of, it might be ecological research or health research, matched then by government. A third example is accelerator programs. We're funding quite a few of these at Nesta, and also supporting or running a European network of accelerators. Now, these are generally in the sort of digital internet space and have spread fastest in the US, and you'll see some of the numbers there in terms of funding generated and exits. Still, to a degree, unproven, but I think what's interesting about the accelerator model is it's trying to almost industrialize the task of startups, of entrepreneurialism and getting quick startups. And part of the relevance for universities here is a few of these are university-based, but they're not tech transfer from the university. They're often taking newly graduated students and getting them working not just on the ideas from within the university, but on problem solving for large firms, so that they move relatively quickly to a contract and then a route to scale. And a lot of money is beginning to go into variants of accelerators. Another example is the spread of labs, living labs, which are essentially applying innovation method, R&D, to perhaps less usual fields. Nesta runs quite a number of these, some with local government, some in relation to health and ageing. In the last year, we've been running a £10 million fund on innovations in giving of money, giving of time, collaborative consumption platforms. And there are a lot of these around the world. New York's Innovation Education Zone is perhaps a particularly good example, which are trying to create much more systematic, structured ways of developing ideas, testing them, measuring what works, and then scaling them, but in fields like secondary school education or social care use of open data in and around the public sector. And my guess is there will be quite a lot more of these in the future, if only because the productivity challenges of the public sector are much bigger than the productivity challenges of the private sector. And there's been an extraordinary failure, I think, over many decades to address public sector productivity in the way it is addressed in the private sector, which is through systematic innovation and measurement and so on. Final point is I think there's a much broader cultural question for governments and innovation institutions about how you embed habits of experiment, risk-taking, measurement into your whole population. And I'll just give two examples from work we're doing at the moment. One is a program which we just launched, in fact, last week, called On Digital Making, which is supporting programs across mainly secondary schools and some primary schools, getting teenagers writing apps, designing games, making digital things, rather than just learning how to use PowerPoint and Excel and so on. Now, there's many reasons for doing that in terms of both the indirect skills children, teenagers develop, but also a critical industrial policy goal. This was the thing asked for by our video games and computing industries. They wanted 18-year-olds who already had that sort of confidence and competence in programming. And in a way, what all of that does is gives you the experience of essentially running an innovation project as part of your normal school education. And in the studio schools, which are now, it's a new model of school spreading very fast in the UK, most of the curriculum is done through real-life practical problem-solving, working with SMEs. And again there, as part of the normal sort of day-to-day curriculum, teenagers learn how to experiment, how to measure, how to scale things, how to turn things into business plans. And I think there's a much broader agenda of mobilizing other institutions to embed a culture of innovation. This slightly odd picture at the bottom is from the cover of something we publish next week, which I think also is relevant to this debate. And this is the a survey we've been doing on use of data analytics in business, and in particular small businesses in the UK. And we've come up with this phrase, the datavores. And that's a datavore you can see there, that sort of thing biting the ones and noughts. And essentially what this is showing is a significant number of businesses really using online analytics as a fundamental part of business management and business planning. There are quite a lot of large businesses doing this as part of their normal activities. Amazon does, Google itself does, and almost running university-type RCTs internally as they test new business models. We found about a small minority of our SMEs beginning to do this and with clear effects on business growth, but the great majority, nothing at all. And yet here's, a set of tools which clearly have dramatic effects on productivity, but also embed the habits of innovation, testing, measurement into normal business processes in just the way the things I was talking about in relation to schools do that into schooling. So those are just a few examples of, I think, some of the new elements of innovation policy, which I don't think displace the tech transfer stuff, the IP, the science parks, the sort of classic, you know, big science, but they complement them and probably have much more of a claim to the marginal dollar than some of those existing sort of 20th century models of innovation. Our problem, as I said, is that we do lack evidence about bang for buck across all of these different fields. But I think where we are moving is towards a much more broad-based notion of innovation policy. And the final thing I'll mention is summed up in those last few words there, that implicit in some of what I've described is a shift of the priorities for innovation away from the priorities essentially of the big state. And the big state did prioritize military innovation as its top priority. And the priorities of big business, which has had an extraordinary influence over R&D spending in the Western world for the last 50 years, I think we're beginning to get a bit more democracy in here of aligning innovation spend more to the things the public care about and want to happen, as well as involving them more in the actual practice, the activities of innovation policy. New Zealand last month launched a quite interesting experiment on public engagement in priorities for science funding. Their science funding is not remotely on your scale here, but it's one of many things we're seeing around the world of trying to change the terms of the debate and really open up innovation policy and innovation practice from recapture by very small groups in societies like the UK with not that much accountability for impact, if we're honest. And this is perhaps the more radical trend we may see in the next few years. Thanks.
Thanks very much to Jeff and to Jim, our guest speakers, for a couple of really stimulating and challenging talks. Let it never be said that the field of innovation is not itself innovative. We've now got a bit of time. This lecture series is known as the Dialogues on Innovation, Creativity and Entrepreneurship. So we want to have a dialogue. I know several of the people in this audience who would have strong views and strong interests in this sector. So I was going to throw it open for questions from the audience to either of our speakers this evening. And in the absence of a question, Jim, can I follow up maybe on and get the ball rolling? You had ABS data on innovation and where businesses source their innovations from. Is that common across the world? Is that a pattern that you see repeated in other countries? Is Australia particularly bad at that? And Jeff might want to comment as well.
I haven't seen cross-country data. It's not a shock that most businesses that think of themselves as innovating are not talking to universities, because they're deploying technologies that are already in the market and taking them to their customers in a new way. The reason why I think it's material, though, is that for universities to remain relevant, you really do need to ask the question of how well do you understand the way that new technologies interact with the business model, business models that ultimately your economy is going to be driving income from. So in a sense, it's more of a question for the university than for the business themselves.
And Jeff, in the UK, I know that there's been a big emphasis over the last decade on bridging that university-business divide, if you like. Any reflections on how that's gone?
Well, I think there's a very live and still unresolved debate, which really goes back 30 or 40 years. So in the 70s, partly influenced by Stanford and Silicon Valley, there was a very strong view that universities had to focus on essentially a linear channel of technology out of the university into business or startups. IP protection was all important. Getting license income from the tech transfer office was the thing you had to do, and so on. And in a way, that model has been tested all over the world and in most places failed. I mean, very few US universities actually made any profit out of trying to do that. And in certainly in the UK, and I think in some other countries, the evidence shows that the key relationship between universities and business is a different one from what that model assumed. First of all, it's much more about people flow than technology IP flow. It's the PhDs going in to work for the large company and taking stuff in their heads rather than, say, the particular product. And in work by a professor called Alan Hughes at Cambridge, which has done a similar kind of survey to the one you showed, Jim, asking business what they get out of universities, it's clear it isn't mainly particular technologies which they then commercialize, but there is a great value to them in being part of what he calls the kind of the public sphere, the technological public sphere orchestrated by universities, the chance to interact with scientists, to come across ideas, sometimes to pose, you know, problem-solving work which is done then with people in the university. And it's a much more sort of network collaborative model of the relationship than that 1970s one of sort of linear flow. But it's surprising, in much of the world, there is still most of the money in the institutions are sort of ignoring that research and still essentially doing the old variant, often at great expense and not much effect.
I wanted to ask a question, which relates to how Australia would select its investments in innovation. Do you think the world is flat, or should a smaller country like Australia carefully select certain topics which would find local application perhaps before they're exporting, bearing in mind that there's a $717 billion gorilla coming along in, I think you said, 2030?
So sort of to offer a contradictory answer, governments have nowhere been very successful at predicting which particular technologies, firms, or even sectors will thrive. And yet, no government can afford not to do that, because you can't cover everything. And there are enough examples of dramatic successes in the last 20 or 30 years, like Taiwan, Israel, Finland, and so on, that clearly there are ways of spotting growth trends and putting your resources into them and being highly strategic and not trying to cover the whole waterfront. I'm not that confident that the gorilla, the elephant, is doing things all that well. I mean, China is throwing a lot of money at a lot of different technology areas, and in many ways emulating what it thinks the US and others did. And I think the great irony of China and India, to some extent, is going for very prestige projects like space and so on, whereas the great strength of their innovation systems in India, it's particularly the strength of frugal innovation, a much lower cost, leaner methods of doing things, which India does far better than Europe or North America. And in China, it's the strength of very, very focused copying, adaptation, and manufacturing systems. So the oddity is, I think, the two biggest sort of new players are, in a way, I think, getting their history a bit wrong. They're trying to copy the wrong bits of the successes of the past. And that means, I think, there will be lots of strategic space for a country like Australia to be canny, to be strategic, and succeed. And I suspect most of the money being thrown in that diagram I showed will be wasted.
I'm John Warren from, I'm with Microsoft Research. And Jeff, I was interested, at the end of your talk you mentioned the word impact. And impact of research is something that we struggle with within Microsoft Research all the time. What is the actual impact of a research project? And how do you measure the impact of a research project? Now, Glyn mentioned in his introduction about the cochlear and work and this new work that's coming to help the blind, which is, they're very tangible outcomes from a research project, which are probably quite easy to measure. But a lot of other research is not easy to measure in our experience. Do you have any comments on that? And is anyone working on, how we know how much, we've got a fair idea as to how much money is spent on R&D and particularly research, but how much is generated as a result of that research? How much wealth is generated as a result of that, and knowledge is generated? Is anyone measuring that?
I mean, pretty much every innovation agency in the world tries to answer your question. And we're part of several networks of similar-ish bodies in countries like Singapore and Finland and so on, all of whom tear their hair out over how on earth to measure impact. At certain stages, you can do it reasonably well. For relatively short periods of time, which particular projects get something to market and what revenues come from that and so on. That you can measure. And I'm sure Microsoft, like most large companies, has its own internal research impact measures. But those become almost completely hopeless over any longer time horizon on any trajectory where you end up is not where you thought you were going to end up. And much of the most important innovation is by its nature speculative. It's a discovery process where the end product or value was inconceivable to the innovator. And so I think there's a sort of core, which is quite tangible and where there are meaningful metrics, and indeed our innovation index actually does measure not just business investment in innovation, but what happened to the bottom line as a result of it. But around that, there are a whole swathe of areas where I think we're talking about a sort of craft knowledge of judgment about what works, and any numbers or metrics are probably more misleading than useful. I mean, one example, we had a lecture last week from the head of Microsoft Research at Cambridge, Stephen Emmett, absolute genius scientist who is reinventing natural science using modelling methods. But no one will really know what value he's created for Microsoft, let alone the world, for probably about 30 years.
Thank you. I think in Australia, it's useful to look at the barriers to innovation. And I think that these include government policy that can move very swiftly and decisively without very much notice after investment has taken place, and also vested interests that act as a lever and push government to not facilitating innovation. An example is in the area of renewable energy, where you would think Australia would be well advanced with, say, solar power, but it's not for the reasons I've just mentioned. And I'm just wondering, given that that seems to be a missed opportunity for Australia, with other countries now being well advanced, as to how governments can be kind of made aware of what they're missing out on by acting in this way.
A comment on this, which is quite live in the UK. We have two ministers for innovation. We have a Liberal Democrat, who's the Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills, and a Conservative, who's the Minister for Science. Both very, very bright, thoughtful ministers. And in a way, they sort of have ended up on slightly different positions on your question. So the science minister is trying to implement, I think, as sensible and sophisticated, a method of engagement with industry to bring in groups of firms, to talk together about research priorities, commercialization priorities, how to organize government money to have the greatest impact in nanotechnology or high-performance computing, etc. And that's all quite sensible, but it means you're almost by definition shaped by the incumbent's view of the future and their interests. His boss, the Liberal, is in some ways quite a 19th century Liberal and wants to be supporting the insurgents, not the incumbents, wants the policy to be, in a sense, driving competition in a much more aggressive way in order to help bring through the more radical innovations, which the incumbents will probably try and kill in the nature of incumbents. And I can't see that either is right or wrong. In a way, I think any innovation strategy has to, as it were, pursue those two poles. One, much more collaborative, consensus-based, and involving a dialogue between government and incumbents. And the other, seeking out disruption and insurgence. And you always need a creative tension between those really two different philosophies of how the world works.
Yeah, over the side. Hi, Josie Gibson. A question for both Jeff and Jim around skills and the culture of innovation in a networked economy. Given that most management practices and organisational structures are pretty much industrial era, could you talk a little bit about the magnitude of the challenge for leaders in removing obstacles to collaboration and how technology is actually accelerating that?
Well, I would just observe that to achieve a culture of the type that one apparently experiences for real in somewhere like Silicon Valley, where you're going to get funded with a higher probability if you've already had two failures, is a big shift from where we are in Australia. It's a relatively risk-averse culture. It's a relatively corporate, short-term delivery culture as opposed to an innovation culture. And you can imagine various pathways, but none of them are short. It's a big shift from that Silicon Valley culture.
It's a very big question you're asking, and I certainly can't answer all of it, but two or three elements. First of all, I've been very influenced by the work of a man called Brian Arthur, who's an economist originally, I think. And whose book on the nature of technology I would really recommend as the best short book, I think, on the nature of innovation today. And interestingly, he didn't use most of the theories he's been working on over the last 20 years for this book. But what it really emphasizes is the deep craft knowledge you get in somewhere like Silicon Valley or in a company like Microsoft. That's to say, a lot of people who've learnt some formal skills, but over time, by doing things, by designing different kinds of software and discovering what works and what doesn't, there's a deeply embedded both individual and collective craft knowledge, which is an extraordinary source of competitive advantage for a region or for a company. And almost the most important thing any place could do is to cultivate deep pools of that kind of craft knowledge in sectors which really matter and will generate wealth. Now, part of the key to Silicon Valley is the people in control of finance also have quite a lot of that craft knowledge because they've been involved in the technology and in backing ventures. One of our problems in the UK is that nearly all the people who control money don't have any of that craft knowledge because they're bankers. Not to be rude about bankers. But it's a completely different sort of approach to innovation. Equally important is that the people in government making those decisions should have that kind of feel for how technology works rather than just being generic bureaucrats. I mean, I'm a generic bureaucrat, so people like me shouldn't be involved in these sort of decisions, because it's a set of judgments built up over time rather than something you can do by the book. That said, one of the reasons we are working quite a lot on innovation skills is there are nevertheless quite a few things which can be learnt and quite quickly to be better, whether you are a startup company or an angel investor or a city policy designer or a foundation. And we're trying to just put a lot of this learning material online free for people to not to make unnecessary mistakes. And my final comment here is the reason that's important is there's a lot of wholly unnecessary mystification around how innovation is done, mainly encouraged by the gurus who try and make it appear much more of an alchemical sort of process. And that's part of their business model. And yet quite a lot of how innovation works and is done, whether in business or the public sector, in fact, is much easier to break down and document and learn than I think that sort of approach recognises.
I think we've got time for one more question. So, lucky last in the front here.
Peter Mountford, Public Systems Innovation. I see one feature that runs consistently through all aspects of innovation and addressing global issues and so forth, which is the need for collaboration. I wonder just how much investment is being made in educating about the need for collaboration and conducting research specifically on the science of collaboration. If you look at it in the context of innovation, where we in Australia might be investing in, for example, automotive technologies or regenerative medicines or so forth, if we were investing in the concept of fostering better collaboration, we would have an investment that would stem both innovation sectors. And it seems to be as a facilitator or the enabling mechanism, there seems to be a great lack of research and education investment in facilitating collaboration, whether it's intergovernment, departmental, government to industry, academia to the public or to government, or whatever it is, international, state by state. Collaboration is what drives innovation and delivers outcome, and effective collaboration works across so many different areas of innovation. So why aren't, or are the UK, I don't think Australia is, why aren't we investing in the science of collaboration?
It's a really interesting question, and certainly some of the most important fields of advance in the next few decades, healthcare, ageing, low carbon, will require collaboration and alignment of what big company, small company, research projects are doing and the designers of regulation and law and so on. And that sort of collaboration isn't well orchestrated, and as you say, there's very little science of it. We're doing two research projects which are an attempt at part of an answer. And the first is also trying to clarify what's optimum collaboration. So we're doing work with Google looking at a lot of the startup companies going through various accelerator programs and incubators. And what I'm hoping we can do is track over several years degrees of networkedness of those startups. And the hypothesis will be you'll get a sort of a curve like that. The ones which aren't networked at all won't do very well. But the ones which are too collaborative and spend all their time talking to other people won't do very well either. And you'll find certain kinds of behaviour, and they'll be different in different sectors at different times, are more optimal in terms of collaboration. Or, you know, anyway, so we may find a completely different pattern, but that would be my guess from other research on sort of network and collaboration behaviour. The other thing which we're about to put out is a tender, actually, for research on university business collaboration platforms, digital platforms for collaboration. Partly because Europe is about to launch a new platform called, rather ugly, REI Search, R-E-I Search, which has been developed by Massimo Marchiori, who developed the underlying technology of Google, Hypersearch. And he's been working for 2 years now on this platform to help multi-researcher collaborations across European universities and globally, and the involvement in business in them. The technology is beautiful, but he was able to find almost no useful research on what would actually work in these collaborations, and in particular, what mix of online and offline, what degrees of orchestration, how you, in a sense, design the walls around the research group to protect for confidentiality as well as IP and so on. And if you know the answer to these questions, I would love to see them, but or maybe you should bid for this tender, because we're going to throw a bit of money at part of this question.
Alrighty. Well, I think that's sorry, Jim, did you want to add something?
No.
I think that's probably all that we have time for tonight. Just wanted to finish up by saying this is the first of our series of dialogues. We will be running more next year. Watch out on the university's public events website to hear some more. I'd like to thank our two guest speakers tonight, Jeff Mulgan and Jim Murphy, for some really stimulating presentations.